This is Audible.
Audible presents this Brilliance audio production of
The Shelters of Stone by Jean M. Owl, Book 5, Earth's Children. Dedication. For Kendall, who knows more about what's to come than almost anyone, except his mother. And for Christy, the mother of his boys. And for Forrest, Skyler, and Slade, three of the best, with love. Chapter 1. People were gathering on the limestone ledge, looking down at them warily. No one made a gesture of welcome, and some held spears in positions of readiness, if not actual threat. The young woman could almost feel their edgy fear. She watched from the bottom of the path as more people crowded together on the ledge, staring down, many more than she had thought there would be. She had seen that reluctance to greet them from other people they had met on their journey. It's not just them, she told herself. It's always that way in the beginning. But she felt uneasy. The tall man jumped down from the back of the young stallion. He was neither reluctant nor uneasy, but he hesitated for a moment, holding the stallion's halter rope. He turned around and noticed that she was hanging back.
"Ayla, will you hold Racer's rope? He seems nervous," he said, then looked up at the ledge. "I guess they do, too."
She nodded, lifted her leg over, slid down from the mare's back, and took the rope. In addition to the tension of seeing strange people, the young brown horse was still agitated around his dam. She was no longer in heat, but residual odors from her encounter with the herd stallion still clung. Ayla held the halter rope of the brown male close, but gave the dun yellow mare a long lead and stood between them. She considered giving Winnie her head. Her horse was more accustomed to large groups of strangers now and was not usually high-strung, but she seemed nervous, too. That throng of people would make anyone nervous. When the wolf appeared, Ayla heard sounds of agitation and alarm from the ledge in front of the cave, if it could be called a cave. She'd never seen one quite like it. Wolf pressed against the side of her leg and moved somewhat in front of her, suspiciously defensive. She could feel the vibration of his barely audible growl. He was much more guarded around strangers now than he had been when they began their long journey a year ago. But he had been little more than a puppy then, and he had become more protective of her after some perilous experiences. As the man strode up the incline toward the apprehensive people, he showed no fear. But the woman was glad for the opportunity to wait behind and observe them before she had to meet them. She'd been expecting, dreading this moment for more than a year, and first impressions were important on both sides. Though others held back, a young woman rushed toward him. Jandala recognized his younger sister immediately, though the pretty girl had blossomed into a beautiful young woman during the 5 years of his absence.
"Jandala, I knew it was you," she said, flinging herself at him. "You finally came home."
He gave her a big hug, then picked her up and swung her around in his enthusiasm.
"Falara, I am so happy to see you."
When he put her down, he looked at her at arm's length.
"But you've grown. You were just a girl when I left. Now you're a beautiful woman. Just as I always knew you'd be,"
he said, with slightly more than a brotherly glint in his eye. She smiled at him, looked into his unbelievably vivid blue eyes, and was drawn by their magnetism. She felt herself flush, not from his compliment, although that's what those standing nearby thought, but from the rush of attraction she felt for the man, brother or not, whom she had not seen for many years. She had heard stories of her handsome big brother with the unusual eyes who could charm any woman, but her memory was of a tall, adoring playmate who was willing to go along with any game or activity she wanted to play. This was the first time as a young woman that she was exposed to the full effect of his unconscious charisma. Jandalar noticed her reaction and smiled warmly at her sweet confusion. She glanced away toward the bottom of the path near the small river.
"Who is that woman, Jande?" she asked. "And where did the animals come from? Animals run away from people. Why don't those animals run away from her? Is she a Selendani? Has she called them?"
Then she frowned.
"Where's Thonolin?"
She took a sharp intake of breath at the look of pain that tightened Jandalar's brow.
"Thonolin travels the next world now, Falara,"
he said.
And I wouldn't be here if it weren't for that woman.
Oh, Chande, what happened?
It's a long story, and this is not the time to tell it, he said.
But he had to smile at the name she called him. It was her personal nickname for him.
I haven't heard that name since I left. Now I know I'm home.
How is everyone, Falara? Is Mother all right, and Willemar?
They're both fine. Mother gave us a scare a couple of years ago, but Zelandani worked her special magic, and she seems fine now. Come and see for yourself, she said, taking his hand and starting to lead him the rest of the way up the path.
Jandalar turned and waved at Ayla, trying to let her know that he would be back soon. He hated leaving her there alone with the animals, but he needed to see his mother, to see for himself that she was all right. That scare bothered him, and he needed to talk to people about the animals. They had both come to realize how strange and frightening it was to most people to see animals that did not run away from them. People knew animals. All the people they had met on their journey hunted them, and most honored or paid homage to them or their spirits in one way or another. Animals had been observed carefully for as long as anyone could remember. People knew the environments they favored and the foods they liked, their migration patterns and seasonal movements, their birthing periods and rutting schedules. But no one had ever tried to touch a living, breathing animal in a friendly way. No one had ever tried to tie a rope around the head of any animal and lead it around. No one had ever tried to tame an animal, or even imagine that one could be. As pleased as these people were to see a kinsman return from a long journey, especially one that few ever expected to see again, the tame animals were such an unknown phenomenon, their first reaction was fear. It was so strange, so inexplicable, so far beyond their experience or imagination, it could not be natural. It had to be unnatural, supernatural. The only thing that kept many of them from running and hiding or attempting to kill the fearsome animals was that Jandalar, whom they knew, had arrived with them, and he was striding up the path from Wood River with his sister, looking perfectly normal under the bright light of the sun. Falara had shown some courage rushing forward the way she had, but she was young and had the fearlessness of youth, and she was so pleased to see her brother, who had always been a special favorite, she couldn't wait. Jandalar would never do anything to harm her, and he didn't fear the animals. Ayla watched from the foot of the path, while people surrounded him, welcoming him with smiles, hugs, kisses, pats, handshakes, using both hands, and many words. She noticed a hugely fat woman, a brown-haired man whom Jandalar hugged, and an older woman that he greeted warmly and then kept his arm around. Probably his mother, she thought, and wondered what the woman would think of her. These people were his family, his kin, his friends, people he had grown up with. She was a stranger, a disturbing stranger, who brought animals, and who knew what other threatening foreign ways and outrageous ideas. Would they accept her? What if they didn't? She couldn't go back. Her people lived more than a year's travel to the east. Jandalar had promised that he would leave with her if she wanted, or was forced, to go. But that was before he saw everyone, before he was greeted so warmly. How would he feel now? She felt a nudge behind her and reached up to stroke Winnie's sturdy neck, grateful that her friend had reminded her that she was not alone. When she lived in the valley, after she left the clan, for a long time the horse had been her only companion. She hadn't noticed the slack in Winnie's rope as the horse moved closer to her, but she gave Racer a bit more lead. The mare and her offspring usually found friendship and comfort in each other, but when the mare came into season, it had disturbed their usual pattern. More people, how could there be so many, were looking in her direction, and Jandalar was talking earnestly with the brown-haired man. Then he waved at her and smiled. When he started back down, he was followed by the young woman, the brown-haired man, and a few others. Ayla took a deep breath and waited. As they approached, the wolf's growl became louder. She reached down to keep him close to her.
"It's all right, Wolf. It's just Jandalar's kin," she said.
Her calming touch was a signal to him to stop growling, not to appear too threatening. The signal had been difficult to teach him, but worth the effort, especially now, she thought. She wished she knew of a touch that would calm her. The group with Jandalar stopped a little distance back, trying not to show their trepidation or to stare at the animals that openly stared at them and held their place, even when strange people approached them. Jandalar stepped into the breach.
"I think we should start with formal introductions, Joharan," he said, looking at the brown-haired man.
As Ayla dropped both halter ropes in preparation for a formal introduction, which required contact with both hands, the horses stepped back, but the wolf stayed. She noticed the glint of fear in the man's eye, although she doubted that this man was afraid of much, and glanced at Jandalar, wondering if he had a reason for wanting formal introductions immediately. She looked closely at the unfamiliar man and was suddenly reminded of Brunn, the leader of the clan that she grew up with. Powerful, proud, intelligent, competent. He had feared little except the world of the spirits.
"Ayla, this is Joharan, leader of the Ninth Cave of the Zelindanyi, son of Marthona, former leader of the Ninth Cave, born to the hearth of Jokonan, former leader of the Ninth Cave."
The tall blonde man said with seriousness, then grinned.
"Not to mention, brother of Jandalar, traveler to distant lands."
There were a few quick smiles. His comment relieved the tension somewhat. Strictly, in a formal introduction, a person could give the entire list of their names and ties to validate their status. All their own designations, titles, and accomplishments, and all their kin and their relationships, along with their titles and accomplishments. And some did. But as a matter of practice, except in the most ceremonial of circumstances, just the primary ones were mentioned. It was not uncommon, however, for young people, especially brothers, to make jocular additions to the long and sometimes tedious recitation of one's kinships, and Jandalar was reminding him of past years before he was burdened with the responsibilities of leadership.
"Joharan, this is Ayla of the Mamutoi, member of the Lion Camp, daughter of the Mammoth Hearth, chosen by the spirit of the cave lion and protected by the cave bear."
The brown-haired man crossed the distance between himself and the young woman and held out both hands, palms up, in the understood gesture of welcome and open-handed friendship. He did not recognize any of her ties, and he wasn't entirely sure which were most important.
"In the name of Dani, the Great Earth Mother, I welcome you, Ayla of the Mamutoi, daughter of the Mammoth Hearth," he said.
Ayla took both his hands.
"In the name of Mut, Great Mother of All, I greet you, Joharan, leader of the Ninth Cave of the Zelindanyi."
Then she smiled.
"And brother of the Traveler Jandalar."
Joharan noticed first that she spoke his language well, but with an unusual accent. Then he became conscious of her strange clothing and her foreign look. But when she smiled, he smiled back. Partly because she had showed her understanding of Jandalar's remark and let Joharan know that his brother was important to her, but mostly because he could not resist her smile. Ayla was an attractive woman by anyone's standards. She was tall, had a firm, well-shaped body, long, dark blonde hair that tended to wave, clear blue-gray eyes, and fine features, though of a slightly different character from those of Zelindanyi women. But when she smiled, it was as if the sun had cast a special beam on her that lit each feature from within. She seemed to glow with such stunning beauty, Joharan caught his breath. Jandalar had always said her smile was remarkable, and he grinned, seeing that his brother was not immune to it. Then Joharan noticed the stallion prance nervously toward Jandalar, and he eyed the wolf.
"Jandalar tells me we need to make some, accommodation for these animals, somewhere nearby, I presume."
Not too near, he thought.
"The horses just need a field with grass, near water, but we need to tell people that they shouldn't try to get close to them in the beginning, unless Jandalar or I am with them. Winnie and Racer are nervous around people until they get used to them," Ayla said.
"I don't think that will be a problem,"
Joharan said, catching the movement of Winnie's tail and eyeing her.
They can stay here, if this small valley is appropriate. This will be fine,
Jondalar said,
though we may move them upstream, out of the way a little.
Wolf is accustomed to sleeping near me,
Ayla continued. She noticed Joharan's frown.
He's become quite protective and might cause a commotion if he can't be close by.
She could see his resemblance to Jondalar, particularly in his forehead, knotted with worry, and wanted to smile. But Joharan was seriously concerned. This was not a time for smiles, even if his expression gave her a feeling of warm familiarity. Jondalar, too, had seen his brother's worried frown.
I think this would be a good time to introduce Joharan to Wolf, he said.
Joharan's eyes flew open in near panic, but before he could object, she reached for his hand as she bent down beside the meat-eater. She put her arm around the large wolf's neck to settle an incipient growl. Even she could smell the man's fear. She was sure Wolf could.
Let him smell your hand first, she said. That's Wolf's formal introduction.
The wolf had learned from previous experience that it was important to Ayla for him to accept within his pack of humans the people she introduced to him in this way. He didn't like the smell of fear, but sniffed the man to become familiar with him.
Have you ever really felt the fur of a living wolf, Joharan?
She asked, looking up at him.
If you notice, it's a little coarse, she said,
leading his hand to feel the animal's rather shaggy neck fur.
He's still shedding and itchy, and he loves to be scratched behind the ears,
she continued, showing him how. Joharan felt the fur, but was more aware of the warmth, and suddenly realized this was a living wolf, and he didn't seem to mind being touched. Ayla observed that his hand was not as stiff, and that he actually attempted to rub the place she indicated.
Let him smell your hand again.
When Joharan brought his hand around toward the wolf's nose, he widened his eyes again with surprise.
That wolf licked me,
he said, not sure if it was in preparation for something better or worse. Then he saw Wolf lick Ayla's face, and she seemed very pleased about it.
Yes, you were good, Wolf,
she said, smiling as she fondled him and roughed up his mane. Then she stood up and patted the front of her shoulders. The wolf jumped up, put his paws on the place she had indicated, and as she exposed her throat, he licked her neck, and then took her chin and jaw in his mouth with a rumbling growl, but great gentleness. Jondalar noticed the gasps of astonishment from Joharan and the others, and realized how frightening the familiar act of wolfish affection must seem to people who didn't understand. His brother looked at him, his expression both fearful and amazed.
What's he doing to her?
Are you sure that's all right?
Falara asked at nearly the same time. She could no longer keep still. The other people were making indecisive, nervous movements as well. Jondalar smiled.
Yes, Ayla is fine. He loves her. He would never hurt her. That's how wolves show affection. It took me a while to get used to it, too, and I've known Wolf as long as she has, ever since he was a fuzzy little cub. That's no cub. That's a big wolf. That's the biggest wolf I ever saw, Joharan said. He could tear her throat out. Yes, he could tear her throat out. I've seen him tear a woman's throat out, a woman who was trying to kill Ayla,
Jondalar said.
Wolf protects her.
The Zelandanyi, who were watching, breathed a collective sigh of relief when the wolf got down and stood by her side again, with his mouth open and his tongue hanging out the side, showing his teeth. Wolf had that look that Jondalar thought of as his wolf grin, as though he was pleased with himself.
Does he do that all the time?
Falara asked.
To anyone?
No, Jondalar said. Only to Ayla, and sometimes me, if he's feeling particularly happy, and only if we allow it. He's well-behaved. He won't harm anyone, unless Ayla is threatened.
What about children?
Falara asked.
Wolves often go after the weak and the young.
At the mention of children, looks of concern appeared on the faces of the people standing nearby.
Wolf loves children, Ayla quickly explained, and he is very protective toward them, particularly very young or weak ones. He was raised with the children of the lion camp.
There was a very weak and sickly boy who belonged to the lion hearth,
Jandalar contributed.
You should have seen them play together. Wolf was always careful around him.
That's a very unusual animal,
another man said.
It's hard to believe a wolf could behave so un-wolf-like. You're right, Suliban,
Jandalar said.
He does behave in ways that seem very un-wolf-like to people, but if we were wolves, we wouldn't think so. He was raised with people, and Ayla says he thinks of people as his pack. He treats people as though they were wolves.
Does he hunt?
The man Jandalar had called Suliban wanted to know.
Yes, Ayla said. Sometimes he hunts alone, for himself, and sometimes he helps us hunt.
How does he know what he should hunt and what he shouldn't? Valara asked.
Like those horses. Ayla smiled. The horses are part of his pack, too. You notice they are not afraid of him, and he never hunts people. Otherwise, he can hunt any animal he wants, unless I tell him not to.
And if you say no, he doesn't?
Another man asked.
That's right, Rushamar,
Jandalar affirmed. The man shook his head in wonder. It was hard to believe anyone could have such control over a powerful hunting animal.
Well, Joharan, Jandalar said, do you think it's safe enough to bring Ayla and Wolf up?
The man thought for a moment, then nodded.
However, if there is any trouble...
There won't be, Joharan,
Jandalar stated, then turned to Ayla.
My mother has invited us to stay with her. Valara still lives with her, but she has her own room, and so does Marthona and Willemar. He's gone on a trading mission now. She's offered her central living space to us. Of course, we could stay with Zelandani at the visitor's hearth, if you'd rather.
I would be pleased to stay with your mother, Jandalar,
Ayla said.
Good. Mother also suggested that we wait with most formal introductions until we get settled in. It isn't as though I need to be introduced, and there's no point in repeating everything to each one when we can do it all at once.
We're already planning a welcoming feast for tonight, Valara said. And probably another one later, for all the nearby caves. I appreciate your mother's thoughtfulness, Jandalar. It would be easier to meet everyone at once, but you might introduce me to this young woman, Ayla said.
Valara smiled.
Of course, I was planning to, Jandalar said. Ayla, this is my sister Valara, blessed of Dani, of the ninth cave of the Zelandani, daughter of Marthona, former leader of the Ninth Cave, born to the hearth of Willemar, traveler and trade master, sister of Joharan, leader of the Ninth Cave, sister of Jandalar.
She knows about you, Jandalar, and I've already heard her names and ties,
Valara said, impatient with the formalities, then held out both hands toward Ayla.
In the name of Dani, the Great Earth Mother, I welcome you, Ayla of the Mamutoi, friend of horses and wolves.
The crowd of people standing on the sunny stone porch quickly moved back when they saw the woman and the wolf start up the path along with Jandalar and the small group accompanying them. One or two took a step closer, while others craned their necks around them. When they reached the stone ledge, Ayla got her first view of the living space of the ninth cave of the Zelandani. The sight surprised her. Though she knew the word cave in the name of Jandalar's home did not refer to a place, but to the group of people who lived there, the formation she saw was not a cave, not as she had thought of one. A cave was a dark chamber, or series of them, within a rock face or cliff, or underground, with an opening to the outside. The living space of these people was the area beneath a huge overhanging shelf jutting out of the limestone cliff. An abris that provided protection from rain or snow, but was open to daylight. The high cliffs of the region were once the floor beneath the surface of an ancient sea. As the calcareous shells of crustaceans who lived in the sea were discarded, they built up on the floor, and eventually became calcium carbonate, limestone. During certain periods of time, for a variety of reasons, some of the deposited shells created thick layers of limestone that were harder than others.
When the earth shifted and exposed the sea floor to eventually become cliffs, the weathering processes of wind and water cut into the relatively softer stone more easily, gouging out deep spaces and leaving ledges of the harder stone between. Although the cliffs were also riddled with caves, which was common for limestone, these unusual shelf-like formations created shelters of stone that made exceptionally good living sites and had been used as such for a great many thousands of years. Jandalar led Ayla toward the older woman she had seen from the foot of the path. The woman was tall and dignified in her bearing as she waited patiently for them. Her hair, more gray than light brown, was pulled back from her face into one long braid which was coiled at the back of her head. Her clear, direct, appraising eyes were also gray. When they reached her, Jandalar began the formal introduction.
"Ayla, this is Marthona, former leader of the Ninth Cave of the Zelindanyi, daughter of Jamara, born to the hearth of Rabinar, mated to Willemar, trade master of the Ninth Cave, mother of Joharan, leader of the Ninth Cave, mother of Folara, blessed of Dani, mother of..."
He started to say Thonolin, hesitated, then quickly filled in,
"Jandalar, returned traveler."
Then he turned to his mother.
"Marthona, this is Ayla of the Lion Camp of the Mamutoi, daughter of the Mammoth Hearth, chosen by the spirit of the cave lion, protected by the spirit of the cave bear."
Marthona held out her two hands.
"In the name of Dani, the great Earth Mother, I welcome you, Ayla of the Mamutoi.
In the name of Mut, great mother of all, I greet you, Marthona of the Ninth Cave of the Zelindanyi, and mother of Jandalar," Ayla said as they joined hands.
Marthona heard Ayla's words, wondered at her strange speech mannerism, noted how well she spoke in spite of it, and thought it was either a minor speech defect or the accent of a completely unfamiliar language from a very distant place. She smiled.
"You have come a long way, Ayla, left all you knew and loved behind. If you had not, I don't think I would have Jandalar back home. I am grateful to you for that. I hope you will soon feel at home here, and I will do all I can to help you."
Ayla knew Jandalar's mother was sincere. Her directness and honesty were genuine. She was glad to have her son back. Ayla was relieved and touched by Marthona's welcome.
"I have looked forward to meeting you since Jandalar first spoke of you, but I have been a little afraid, too,"
she replied with a similar directness and honesty.
"I don't blame you. I would have found it very difficult in your place. Come, let me show you where you can put your things. You must be tired and would like to rest before the welcoming celebration tonight,"
Marthona said, starting to lead them toward the area under the overhang. Suddenly Wolf started whining, yelped a little puppy bark, and stretched his front paws out with his back end and tail up in a playful posture. Jandalar was startled.
"What is he doing?"
Ayla looked at Wolf, rather surprised as well. The animal repeated his gestures, and suddenly she smiled.
"I think he's trying to get Marthona's attention," she said. "He thinks she didn't notice him, and I think he wants to be introduced."
"And I want to meet him, too," Marthona said.
"You don't fear him," Ayla said, "and he knows it."
"I watched. I didn't see anything to fear," she said, extending her hand toward the wolf.
He sniffed her hand, licked it, and whined again.
"I think Wolf wants you to touch him. He does love attention from people he likes," Ayla said.
"You do like that, don't you?"
the older woman said as she stroked him.
"Wolf, is that what you called him?"
"Yes. It's just the Mamutoi word for wolf. It seemed like the right name for him," Ayla explained.
"But I've never seen him take to anyone so fast,"
Jandalar said, looking at his mother with awe.
"Nor have I," Ayla said, watching Marthona with the wolf. "Maybe he's just happy to meet someone who's not afraid of him."
As they walked into the shade of the overhanging stone, Ayla felt an immediate cooling of temperature. For a heartbeat, she shivered with a chill of fear and glanced up at the huge shelf of stone jutting out of the cliff wall, wondering if it could collapse. but when her eyes grew accustomed to the dimmer light, she was astonished by more than the physical formation of Jandalar's home. The space under the rock shelter was huge, much larger than she had imagined. She had seen similar overhangs in the cliffs along this river on their way here, some obviously inhabited, though none seemed quite as sizable as this one. Everyone in the entire region knew of the immense rock shelter and the great number of people it housed. The ninth cave was the largest of all the communities that called themselves Zelandanyi. Clustered together at the eastern end of the protected space, along the back wall and freestanding in the middle, were individual structures, many quite large, made partly of stone and partly of wooden frames covered with hides. The hides were decorated with beautifully rendered pictures of animals and various abstract symbols painted in black and many vivid shades of red, yellow, and brown. The structures were arranged in a west-facing curve around an open space near the center of the area covered by the overhanging stone shelf, which was filled with a confusion of objects and people. As Ayla looked more closely, what at first had struck her all at once as a melange of rich clutter was resolving itself into areas dedicated to different tasks, often near to related tasks. It only seemed confusing initially because so many activities were going on. She saw hides being cured in frames and long shafts of spears, apparently in the process of being straightened, leaning against a crosspiece supported by two posts. Baskets, in different stages of completion, were stacked in another place, and thongs were drying stretched between pairs of bone posts. Long skeins of cordage hung from pegs pounded into crossbeams above unfinished nets stretched across a frame, and loosely woven netting in bundles on the ground. Skins, some dyed various colors, including many shades of red, were cut into pieces, and nearby, partially assembled articles of clothing were hanging. She recognized most of the crafts, but near the clothing was an activity that was entirely unfamiliar. A frame held many strands of thin cord vertically, with a design partially formed from the material woven horizontally across them. She wanted to go over and look closer, and promised herself she would later. Pieces of wood, stone, bone, antler, and mammoth ivory were in other places, carved into implements, ladles, spoons, bowls, tongs, weapons, most of them with carved and sometimes painted decorations. There were also small sculptures and carvings that were not implements or tools. They seemed to be made for themselves, or some purpose of which she wasn't aware. She saw vegetables and herbs hanging high from large frames with many crosspieces, and lower to the ground, meat drying on racks. Somewhat away from other activities was an area scattered with sharp stone chips for people like Jandalar, she thought, flint knappers who made tools, knives, and spear points. And everywhere she looked, she saw people. The community that lived under the spacious rock shelter was of a size to match the space. Ayla had grown up in a clan of less than 30 people. At the clan gathering, which occurred once every 7 years, 200 people came together for a short period, a huge assembly to her then. Though the Mumutoi summer meeting drew a much greater number, the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi alone, comprised of over 200 individuals living together at this one place, was larger than the entire clan gathering. Ayla didn't know how many people were standing around watching them, but she was reminded of the time she had walked with Brun's clan into that congregation of clans and felt all of them looking at her. They had tried to be unobtrusive, but the people who were staring as Marthona led Jandalar, Ayla, and a wolf to her living place weren't even polite about it. They didn't try to look down or glance away. She wondered if she would ever get used to living with so many people living close by all the time. She wondered if she wanted to. Chapter 2 The huge woman glanced up at the movement of the leather drape stretched across the entrance, then quickly looked down as the young blonde stranger emerged from Marthona's dwelling. She was sitting in her accustomed place, a seat carved out of a solid block of limestone, strong enough to support her massive bulk. The leather-padded stone seat had been made especially for her, and was located exactly where she wanted it, toward the back of the large open area under the enormous overhanging cliff that protected the settlement, but within sight of almost the entire communal living space. The woman appeared to be meditating, but it wasn't the first time she had used the place to quietly observe some person or activity. The people had learned not to intrude upon her meditations unless it was an emergency, especially when she wore her ivory chest plaque with the plain, undecorated side facing out. When the side that was carved with symbols and animals was showing, anyone was free to approach her. But when she reversed the plaque to the blank side, it became a symbol of silence and meant that she did not wish to speak and did not want to be disturbed. The cave had grown so accustomed to her being there they almost didn't see her, for all her unusually commanding presence. She had cultivated that effect carefully, and had no compunctions about it. As spiritual leader of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi, she considered the welfare of the people her responsibility, and used every means her fertile brain could devise to carry out her duty. She watched the younger woman leave the rock shelter and head toward the path that led to the valley, and noticed the unmistakably foreign look of her leather tunic. The old Danyer was also aware that she moved with a resilience of health and strength, and a confidence that belied her youth and the fact that she was among complete strangers in their living place. Zelandani got up and walked toward the structure, one of the many such dwelling places of various sizes scattered within the limestone abris. At the entrance to the dwelling that divided the private living space from the open public area, she tapped on the stiff rawhide panel next to the draped closed entry and heard the padded strides of soft leather footwear approaching. The tall, fair-haired, surprisingly handsome man pulled back the drape. Eyes of an unusually vivid shade of blue looked surprised, then warmed with pleasure.
"Zelandani, how nice to see you," he said. "But Mother isn't here right now."
"What makes you think I'm here to see Marthona? You're the one who's been gone 5 years."
Her tone was sharp. He was suddenly flustered and at a loss for words.
"Well, are you going to leave me standing out here, Jondalar?"
"Oh, come in, of course," he said, his brow knotting into a habitual frown, erasing the warm smile.
He stepped back, holding the drape aside as she entered. They studied each other in silence for a time. When he left, she had just become first among those who served the mother. She'd had 5 years to grow into the position, and she had grown into it. The woman he knew had become immensely fat. She was 2 or 3 times the size of most women, with huge breasts and broad buttocks. She had a soft, full face, crowded by 3 chins, but her piercing blue eyes seemed to miss nothing. She had always been tall and strong, and she carried her great size with grace and a demeanor that asserted her prestige and authority. She had a presence, an aura of power about her that commanded respect. They both spoke at once.
"Can I get you?"
Jondalar started. "You've changed."
"I'm sorry."
He apologized for what seemed like an interruption, feeling oddly constrained. Then he noticed just the slightest hint of a smile and a familiar look in her eye, and he felt himself relax.
"I'm glad to see you, Zolina," he said.
His brows smoothed out, and his smile returned as he focused his compelling eyes full of warmth and love on her.
"You haven't changed that much,"
she said, feeling herself respond to his charisma and the memories it evoked.
"No one has called me Zolina for a long time."
She appraised him again carefully.
"You have changed, though. Grown up some. You're more handsome than ever."
He started to protest, but she shook her head at him.
"Don't make objections, Jondalar. You know it's true. But there's a difference. You look... how can I say it? You don't have that hungry look, that need that every woman wanted to satisfy. I think you have found what you've been searching for. You're happy in a way that you've never been."
"I never could keep anything from you,"
he said, smiling with an excited, almost childlike delight.
"It's Ayla.
We planned to mate at this summer's matrimonial. I suppose we could have had a mating ceremony before we left or along the way, but I wanted to wait until we got home so you could slip that thong over our wrists and tie the knot for us.
Just talking about her had changed his expression, and Zelandani had a momentary sense of the almost obsessive love he felt for this woman called Ayla. It concerned her, raised all the protective instincts she felt for her people, particularly this person, as the voice, surrogate, and instrument of the great Earth Mother. She knew the powerful emotions he had struggled with growing up and finally learned to keep under control. But a woman he loved that much could hurt him terribly, perhaps even destroy him. Her eyes narrowed. She wanted to know more about this young woman who had captivated him so completely. Just what kind of hold did she have on him?
How can you be so sure she's right for you? Where did you meet her? How much do you really know about her?
Jondalar sensed her concern, but something else, too, something that worried him. Zelandani was the highest-ranked spiritual leader of all the Zelandanya, and she was not first for nothing. She was a powerful woman, and he didn't want her turning against Ayla. The greatest concern he, and he knew Ayla too, had during their long and difficult journey to his home was whether or not she would be accepted by his people. For all her exceptional qualities, there were some things about her that he wished she would keep secret, though he doubted that she would. She could have enough difficulties, and probably would have from some people, without incurring the enmity of this particular woman. Quite the opposite. More than anyone, Ayla needed the support of Zelandani. He reached out and held the shoulders of the woman, needing to persuade her somehow not only to accept Ayla but to help her. But he wasn't sure how. Looking into her eyes, he couldn't help remembering the love they once had shared. And suddenly he knew that, as difficult as it might be for him, only complete honesty would work, if anything would. Jondalar was a private man about his personal feelings. It was the way he'd learned to control his powerful emotions, to keep them to himself. It was not easy for him to talk about them to anyone, not even someone who knew him as well as she did.
Zelandani.
His voice softened.
Zolina. You know it was you that spoiled me for other women. I was hardly more than a boy, and you were the most exciting woman any man could hope for. I wasn't alone in wetting my dreams with thoughts of you, but you made mine come true. I burned for you, and when you came to me, became my Danyi woman, I couldn't get enough of you. My first manhood was filled with you, but you know it didn't end there. I wanted more, and as much as you fought it, you did too. Even though it was forbidden, I loved you, and you loved me. I still love you. I will always love you. Even afterwards, after all the trouble we caused everyone, and Mother sending me to live with Dalinar, when I came back, no one ever came close to you. I hungered for you, lying spent beside another woman, and I hungered for more than your body. I wanted to share a hearth with you. I didn't care about the difference in age, or that no man was supposed to fall in love with his Danyi woman. I wanted to spend my life with you.
And look what you would have gotten, Jondalar, Zolina said. She was moved, more than she imagined she could be any more.
Have you taken a good look? I'm not just older than you. I'm so fat, I'm starting to have trouble getting around. I'm still strong, or I'd have more. And will, as time goes on.
You are young, and so good to look at. Women ache for you. The mother chose me. She must have known I would grow to look like her. That's fine for Zelandani, but at your hearth I would have been just a fat old woman, and you would still be a handsome young man.
Do you think I would have cared? Zolina, I had to travel beyond the end of the Great Mother River before I found a woman who could compare with you. You can't imagine how far that is. I would do it again and more. I thank the Great Mother that I found Ayla. I love her, as I would have loved you. Be good to her, Zolina. Zelandani, don't hurt her.
That's just it. If she's right for you, if she compares... I couldn't hurt her, and she wouldn't hurt you, could not.
That's what I need to know, Jandalar. They both looked up as the drape over the entrance was moved aside. Ayla came into the dwelling carrying traveling packs and saw Jandalar holding the shoulders of an enormously fat woman. He pulled his hands away, looking disconcerted, almost ashamed, as though he was doing something wrong. What was it about the way Jandalar was looking at the woman, about the way his hands had held her shoulders? And the woman, in spite of her size, there was a seductive quality to the way she held her body. But another characteristic quickly asserted itself. As she turned to look at Ayla, she moved with a sense of assurance and composure that was a manifest sign of her authority. Observing small details of expression and posture for meaning was second nature to the young woman. The clan, the people who raised her, did not speak primarily with words. They communicated with signs, gestures, and nuances of facial expression and stance. When she lived with a Mamutoi, her ability to interpret body language had evolved and expanded to include understanding the unconscious signals and gestures of those who used spoken language. Suddenly, Ayla knew who the woman was and realized something important had transpired between the man and the woman that involved her. She sensed she was facing a critical test, but she didn't hesitate.
"She's the one, isn't she, Jandalar?" Ayla said, approaching them.
"I'm the one what?" Zelandani said, glaring at the stranger. Ayla stared back at the woman without flinching.
"You're the one I must thank," she said. "Until I met Jandalar, I didn't understand about the mother's gifts, especially her gift of pleasure. I had only known pain and anger, but he was patient and gentle, and I learned to know the joy. He told me about the woman who taught him. I thank you, Zelandani, for teaching Jandalar so he could give me her gift. But I am grateful to you for something much more important and more difficult for you. Thank you for giving him up so he could find me."
Zelandani was surprised, though she showed little sign of it. Ayla's words were not at all what she expected to hear. Their eyes locked as the woman studied Ayla, searching for a sense of her depth, a perception of her feelings, an insight to the truth. The older woman's comprehension of unconscious signals and body language was not dissimilar to Ayla's, though more intuitive. Her ability had developed through subliminal observation and instinctive analysis, not the expanded application of a language learned as a child, but was no less astute. Zelandani didn't know how she knew, she just knew. It took a moment before she became aware of something curious. Though the young woman seemed to be entirely fluent in Zelandani, her command of the language was so good she used it like one born to it, there could be no doubt she was a foreigner. The one who served was not unfamiliar with visitors who spoke with the accent of another language, but Ayla's speech had a strangely exotic quality, unlike anything she'd ever heard. Her voice was not unpleasant, somewhat low-pitched, but a little throaty, and she had trouble with certain sounds. She recalled Jandalar's remark about how far he had gone on his journey, and a thought crossed Zelandani's mind in the few heartbeats that the two women stood confronting each other. This woman had been willing to travel a great distance to come home with him. Only then did she notice that the young woman's face had a distinctly foreign look, and tried to identify the difference. Ayla was attractive, but one expected that of any woman Jandalar would bring home. Her face was somewhat broader and shorter than that of Zelandani women, but nicely proportioned, with a well-defined jaw. She was a shade taller than the older woman, and her rather dark blonde hair was enhanced with sun-lightened streaks. Her clear gray-blue eyes held secrets, a strong will, but no hint of malice. Zelandani nodded and turned to Jandalar.
"She'll do."
He let out a breath, then looked from one to the other.
"How did you know this was Zelandani, Ayla? You haven't been introduced yet, have you?"
"It was not hard. You still love her, and she loves you."
But how?" he sputtered.
"Don't you know? I've seen that look in your eyes. Don't you think I understand how a woman who loves you feels inside?" Ayla said.
Some people would be jealous if they saw someone they loved looking at someone else with love, he said.
Zelandani suspected that the some people he was thinking of was himself.
Don't you think she can see a handsome young man and a fat old woman, Jandalar? It's what anyone would see. Your love for me is no threat to her. If your memory still blinds you, I am grateful enough.
She turned to Ayla.
I wasn't sure about you. If I had felt you weren't right for him, it would not matter how far you have traveled. You would never mate him.
Nothing you could do would stop it, Ayla said.
See,
Zelandani said, turning to look at Jandalar.
I told you if she was right for you, I couldn't hurt her.
Did you think Morona was right for me, Zelandani?
Jandalar said with a touch of irritation, beginning to feel as though between them he had no right to make up his own mind.
You never objected when I was promised to her.
That didn't matter. You didn't love her. She couldn't hurt you.
Both women were looking at him, and though they bore no resemblance to each other, their expressions were so similar they seemed to look alike.
Suddenly Jandalar laughed. Well, I'm glad to know the two loves of my life are going to be friends, he said.
Zelandani raised an eyebrow and gave him a stern look.
Whatever makes you think we're going to be friends, she said,
but she smiled to herself as she left. Jandalar felt a strange set of mixed emotions as he watched Zelandani leave, but he was pleased that the powerful woman appeared willing to accept Ayla. His sister had been friendly toward her, too, and his mother. All the women that he really cared about seemed ready to welcome her, at least for now, he thought. His mother had even told her she would do whatever she could to make Ayla feel at home. The leather drape across the entrance moved, and Jandalar felt a tingle of surprise when he saw his mother, since he had just been thinking about her. Marthona entered, carrying the preserved stomach of some middle-sized animal full of a liquid that had seeped through the nearly waterproof container enough to stain it a deep purple.
Jandalar's face lit up with a grin. "Mother, you brought out some of your wine," he said. "Ayla, do you remember the drink that we had when we stayed with the Sharamadoi, the bilberry wine? Now you'll get a chance to taste Marthona's wine. She's known for it. No matter what fruit most people use, their juice often turns sour. But Mother has a way with it."
He smiled at her and added,
"Maybe someday she'll tell me her secret."
Marthona smiled back at the tall man, but made no comment. From her expression, Ayla sensed that she did have a secret technique and that she was good at keeping secrets, not only her own. She probably knew many. There were layers and hidden depths to the woman, for all that she was forthright and honest in what she said. And for all that she was friendly and welcoming, Ayla knew that Jandalar's mother would reserve judgment before fully accepting her. Suddenly Ayla was reminded of Issa, the woman of the clan who had been like a mother to her. Issa also knew many secrets, yet, like the rest of the clan, she didn't lie. With a language of gestures and nuances conveyed by postures and expressions, they couldn't lie. It would be known immediately, but they could refrain from mentioning. Though it might be understood that something was held back, it was allowed for the sake of privacy. This was not the first time she had been reminded of the clan recently, she realized. The Ninth Cave's leader, Jandalar's brother Joharan, had reminded her of Brun, her clan's leader. Why did Jandalar's kin remind her of the clan, she wondered.
"You must be hungry," Marthona said, including both of them in her glance. Jandalar smiled. "Yes, I am hungry. We haven't eaten since early this morning. I was in such a hurry to get here, and we were so close I didn't want to stop." "If you've brought all your things in, sit and rest while I prepare some food for you."
Marthona led them to a low table, indicated cushions for them to sit on, and poured some of the deep red liquid into cups for each of them. She looked around.
"I don't see your wolf animal, Ayla. I know you brought him in. Does he also need food? What does he eat?"
"I usually feed him whatever we eat, but he also hunts for himself. I brought him in so he would know where his place is, but he came with me the first time I went back down to the valley where the horses are, and decided to stay. He comes and goes on his own unless I want him."
Ayla said.
How does he know when you want him?
She has a special whistle to call him,
Jandalar said.
We call the horses with whistles, too.
He picked up his cup, tasted, then smiled and sighed with appreciation.
Now I know I'm home.
He tasted again, then closed his eyes and savored.
What fruit is this made from, Mother?
Mostly from those round berries that grow in clusters on long vines, only on protected south-facing slopes,
Marthona explained for Ayla's benefit.
There's an area several miles southeast of here that I always check. Some years it doesn't grow well at all, but we had a fairly warm winter a few years back, and the following autumn the clusters were huge, very fruity, sweet, but not too sweet. I added a little elderberry and some blackberry juice, but not much. This wine was a favorite. It's a little stronger than usual. I don't have much left.
Ayla sniffed the aroma of fruit as she held the cup to her lips to taste. The liquid was tart and tangy, dry, not the sweet taste she had expected from the fruity smell. She sensed the alcoholic character she had first tasted in the birch beer made by Talut, the Lion Camp's headman. But this was more like the fermented bilberry juice made by the Sharamadoi, except that that had been sweeter, as she recalled. She hadn't liked the harsh bite of alcohol when she first experienced it, but the rest of the Lion Camp seemed to enjoy the birch beer so much, and she wanted to fit in and be like them, so she made herself drink it. After a time, she got more used to it, though she suspected that the reason people liked it was not as much for its taste as for the heady, if disorienting, feeling it caused. Too much usually made her feel giddy and too friendly, but some people became sad or angry or even violent. This beverage had something more, however. Elusive complexities altered the simple character of the fruit juice in an extraordinary way. It was a drink she could learn to enjoy.
"This is very good," Ayla said. "I not ever tasted anything... I never tasted anything quite like it,"
she corrected herself, feeling slightly embarrassed. She was completely comfortable in Zelindanyi. It was the first spoken language she had learned after living with the clan. Jandalar had taught her while he was recovering from the wounds of the lion mauling. Though she did have difficulty with certain sounds, no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't get them quite right. She seldom made mistakes in phrasing like that anymore. She glanced at Jandalar and Marthona, but they hadn't seemed to notice. She relaxed and looked around. Though she had been in and out of Marthona's dwelling several times, she had not really looked at it closely. She took the time to observe more carefully and was surprised and delighted at every turn. The construction was interesting, similar but not the same as the dwellings inside the Los Adunai cave, where they had stopped to visit before crossing the glacier on the high plateau. The first 2 or 3 feet of the outside walls of each dwelling were constructed of limestone. Fairly large blocks were roughly trimmed and placed on either side of the entry, but stone tools were not suitable for finely shaping building stone easily or quickly. The rest of the low walls were made up of limestone as it was found, or roughly shaped with a hammer stone. Various pieces, generally close to the same size, perhaps 2 or 3 inches wide, not quite as deep, and 3 or 4 times longer than they were wide, but some larger and some smaller pieces, were ingeniously fitted together so that they interlocked into a tight, compressive structure. The roughly lozenge-shaped pieces were selected and graded for size, then arranged side by side lengthwise so that the width of the walls was equivalent to the length of the stones. The thick walls were constructed in layers so that each stone was placed in the dip where the 2 stones under it came together. Occasionally, smaller stones were used to fill in gaps, especially around the larger blocks near the entry. As they were layered up, they were corbelled inward slightly, cantilevered in such a way that each successive layer overhung the layer below by a little. Careful selection and placement were done so that any irregularities in the stone contributed to the runoff of moisture on the outside, whether it was rainwater blown in, accumulated condensation, or ice melt. No mortar or mud was needed to plug holes or add support. The rough limestone offered purchase enough to prevent sliding or slipping, and the mass of stones was held by its own weight and could even take the thrust of a beam of juniper or pine inserted into the walls to support other building elements or shelving structures. The stones were so cunningly fitted together that no chink of light showed through and no errant blasts of winter wind could find an opening. The effect was also quite attractive, with a pleasing texture, especially seen from outside. Inside, the stone windbreak wall was all but hidden by a second wall made of panels of rawhide, untreated leather that dried stiff and hard, attached to wooden posts sunk into the dirt floor. The panels began at ground level, but extended above the stone walls vertically to a height of 8 or 9 feet. Ayla recalled that the upper panels were lavishly decorated on the outside. Many of the panels were also painted with animals and enigmatic marks on the inside, but the colors seemed less bright because it was darker inside. Because Marthona's structure was built against the slightly sloping back of the cliff underneath the overhanging shelf, one wall of the dwelling was solid limestone. Ayla looked up. There was no ceiling except the underside of the stone ledge some distance above. With the exception of occasional downdrafts, smoke from fires rose over the wall panels and drifted out along the lofty stone, leaving the air essentially clear. The cliff overhang protected them from inclement weather, and with warm clothing, the dwellings could be quite comfortable even when it was cold. They were fairly large, not like some of the cozy, easy-to-heat, fully enclosed, but often smoke-filled little living spaces she had seen. While the wooden leather walls offered protection from wind and rain that might blow in, they were designed more to define an area of personal space and provide some measure of privacy, at least from eyes, if not ears. Some of the upper sections of the panels could be opened to admit light and neighborly conversations if desired, but when the window panels were closed, it was considered courteous for visitors to use the entry and ask for admittance, not just call out from outside or walk in. Ayla examined the floor more closely when her eye caught sight of stones fitted together. The limestone of the huge cliffs in the region could be broken and often sheared off naturally along the lines of its crystal structure into large, rather flat fragments. The dirt floor inside the dwelling was paved with irregular sections of the flat stones, then covered with mats woven out of grasses and reeds, and rugs of soft fur. Ayla turned her attention back to the conversation between Jandalar and his mother. Taking a sip of the wine, she noticed the cup in her hand. It was made of a hollow horn, bison, she thought, probably a section cut off not too far from the tip since it was rather narrow in diameter. She lifted it up to look underneath. The bottom was wood, shaped to fit the smaller, slightly lopsided circular end, and wedged in tight. She saw scratch marks on the side, but when she looked more closely, she was surprised to find that it was a picture of a horse from side view, perfectly and delicately engraved. She put the cup down, then inspected the low platform around which they were seated. It was a thin slab of limestone, resting on a supporting bentwood frame with legs, all lashed together with thongs. The top was covered with a mat of some kind of rather fine fiber, woven with intricate designs that suggested animals and various abstract lines and shapes in gradations of an earthy reddish color. Several pillows made of various materials were arranged around it. The leather ones were of a similar shade of red. 2 stone lamps rested on the stone table. One was beautifully carved and shaped into a shallow bowl with a decorated handle. The other was a rough equivalent with a depression that had been quickly pecked out of the center of a hunk of limestone. Both held melted tallow, animal fat, that had been rendered in boiling water, and burning wicks. The roughly made lamp had 2 wicks, and the finished one 3. Each wick shed the same amount of light. Ayla had the feeling that the rougher one had been made recently for quick additional lighting in the dimly lit dwelling space at the back of the abri, and would see only temporary use. The interior space, divided into 4 areas by movable partitions, was orderly and uncluttered, and lighted by several more stone lamps. The dividing screens, most colored or decorated in some way, also had wood frames, some with opaque panels, usually the stiff rawhide of uncured leather. But a few were translucent, probably made of some large animal's intestines that had been cut open and dried flat, Ayla thought. At the left end of the back stone wall, adjacent to an exterior panel, was an especially beautiful screen that appeared to be made of the shadow skin, the parchment-like material that could be removed in large sections from the inner side of animal hides if it was left to dry without scraping. A horse and some enigmatic designs, which included lines, dots, and squares, had been drawn on it in black and shades of yellow and red. Ayla recalled that the mammut of the lion camp had used a similar screen during ceremonies, although the animals and markings on his were painted only in black. His had come from the shadow skin of a white mammoth, and was his most sacred possession. On the floor in front of the screen was a grayish fur that Ayla was sure came from the hide of a horse in thick winter coat. The glow of a small fire, which seemed to come from a niche in the wall behind it, lighted the horse screen, emphasizing its decorations. Shelves, made of thinner segments of limestone than the paving and spaced at various intervals, lined the stone wall to the right of the screen and held an array of objects and implements. Vague shapes could be seen on the floor in a storage area below the lowest shelf, where the slope of the wall was deepest. Ayla recognized the functional use of many of the things, but some had been carved and colored with such skill they were objects of beauty as well. To the right of the shelves, a leather-paneled screen jutting out from the stone wall marked the corner of the room and the beginning of another room. The screens only suggested a division between the rooms, and through an opening Ayla could see a raised platform piled high with soft furs. Someone's sleeping space, she thought. Another sleeping space was loosely defined by screens, dividing it from the room they occupied and from the first sleeping room. The draped entrance was part of the wall of wood-framed hide panels opposite the stone wall, and on the side across from the sleeping spaces was a fourth room where Marthona was preparing food. Along the entry wall near the cooking room, freestanding wooden shelves held artfully arranged baskets and bowls, beautifully decorated with carved, woven, or painted geometric designs and realistic depictions of animals. Larger containers were on the floor next to the wall, some with lids, while others openly revealed their contents, vegetables, fruits, grains, dried meats. There were four sides to the roughly rectangular dwelling, though the outside walls were not perfectly straight, nor the spaces entirely symmetrical. They curved somewhat unevenly, tending to follow the contours of the space under the overhanging shelf, and made allowances for other dwellings.
"You've changed things around, Mother," Jandalar said. "It seems roomier than I remember."
"It is roomier, Jandalar. There's only three of us here now. Falara sleeps in there,"
Marthona said, indicating the second sleeping space.
"Willemar and I sleep in the other room."
She motioned toward the room against the stone wall.
"You and Ayla may use the main room. We can move the table closer to the wall to make room for a bed platform, if you like."
To Ayla, the place seemed quite roomy. The dwelling was much larger than the individual living spaces of each hearth, each family, in the semi-subterranean longhouse of the lion camp, although not as big as her small cave in the valley where she had lived alone. But unlike this living area, the Mammutoi Lodge was not a natural formation. The people of the lion camp had made it themselves. Her attention was drawn to the nearby partition that separated the cooking space from the main room. It bent in the middle, and she realized it was two translucent screens connected in an unusual way.